We're doing our class on Parsha. We're continuing our class on the Parsha, Parshat Vayishlach. We had left off at a suspenseful moment. The brothers had entered the castle of Shechem. They were ready to charge. They had wiped out everyone who was in their way, and now they enter that special room where Shechem is lying in pain after his circumcision, and they want to kill Shechem, and Dina stands in their way and says, "Don't!"
Is this a midrash?
Yes. And the brothers ask her why. And here the midrash gives us numerous different answers. One answer the Midrash tells us is that it is difficult for a woman to separate herself from the foreskin. When a woman has experienced being intimate with a non-Jew, so then even a Jewish woman will find herself drawn and attracted, and it is difficult to separate.
Because it's more pleasurable?
I think Chazal meant it as an illusion. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Chazal meant it literally, as far as her physical pleasure. I'm not sure. I have the wording, that's why I quoted the wording for you, so that you'd see the dual understanding here. Chazal did stress that aspect of it. I'm not sure that's the idea.
Because that's, like, it's also a thing that it's more pleasant. I mean,
I'm not sure that's what Chazal were coming to say. I think it could be, but in Tanakh and in Midrashim, the foreskin represents something. It's very often not just the physical aspect of the act, and much more connecting to the physicality of life in general, rather than just a physical, technical detail in the act of intimacy. So that's one answer Chazal tell us. A second answer Chazal tell us is that Dina said, "Who will marry me? It's easy for you to say, leave, we'll kill him. But what life will I head to?" Now, in this story, we see an insight that we don't exactly understand today. We would think that a woman who was kidnapped and violated would hate the guy, would never want to have anything to do with him, would be the first to say, kill him. Her brothers finally broke into the palace, and she has a future. But this is a recurring theme we encounter in Tanakh. When Amnon violates his sister Tamar, she says, "You're kicking me out of your house is worse than the first thing you did to me. So why would you want to stay in his house?" What does that mean? It seems that women in ancient times had a different perspective on things. I was a little boy. I once read a biography that a woman wrote in the days of the pirates. In the days, it was a woman who was captured by pirates, and I don't remember the details of her biography, but one of the things she wrote there was that she knows how every good woman has to approach life, and that her body is not her own, and whatever ends up happening with her doesn't really make such of a difference to her. She's well aware that she will have to undergo certain physical pain at the hands of men who will be brutal with her, and that is something she's prepared for. Like she writes in her biography, she knows what life is, what's waiting for her in life, and that's a very obvious thing to her, and that doesn't scare her. She writes in her biography. She writes other things scare her. She says physical violence, she knows. She knows she's seen how other women live, and she understands that men get drunk, and men get violent, and men beat their wives, and she understands that part of being a good wife is every so often taking a harsh beating. She writes all kinds of things that like to us are like crazy. Right? That you read a Talmud, you see what the Talmud says. That's That's called, Talmud uses the harshest terms. That's called a human marrying a lion. If a woman marries a man that's violent, then the Talmud says he's subhuman. The Talmud says you can't eat at such a wedding. The Talmud says there's no dancing at such a wedding. If you have any reason to think that he's not going to be kind to her as a husband, so that's there's no mitzvah in that wedding. The Talmud uses the harshest terms about a husband who's violent to his wife. Our perspective is totally different. But again, I remember as a kid reading this biography and realizing that the life was different. A girl writes that she's perfectly prepared to be a good wife, and she knows that that will mean that every so often her husband's going to beat her. That's obvious to her. And when we say beat, we're talking about merciless beating. We're not talking about, whatever. On some level, Dina is saying, even though I wasn't interested in this guy, but he can be a husband. And if I leave him, I'll spend the rest of my life alone. Who's going to want to marry me after this? And that's the same claim that Tamar made after Amnon violated her. She says, why are you kicking me out of your house? You wanted me, fine, so I'll be your wife. Again, we would look at that differently. We would look at that as, go to your dad, your father's the king, have him killed. And Tamar says, what do I want him dead for? Right now he could end up being my husband. We would say, what do you want a husband like that for? And Tamar says, it's better than the alternative to spend my whole life alone. He's not the nicest guy, okay, but at least I'll build a family, I'll build a life, I'll have something. And here you see Dina's perspective is like that too. Dina says, who's going to marry me? What are you taking me? I understand you want to kill him. You're going to resolve that problem. You're creating a new problem. What solution are you offering me?
Out of the frying pan into the fire.
So here there are different versions as to what happened. One version of the Medrash says that the brothers basically said, lady, get out of the way. And they went and killed him. And they dragged her by her hair and they said, you're coming home. Whether you like it or not, this isn't your place. This isn't the way we lead our lives. And whatever will be, will be. They weren't willing to listen, to entertain her argument. Another version says that one of her brothers promised her, I'll marry you. You will be in my house. You have nothing to worry about. But the story goes on because when Dina comes home, after everything she's been through, Dina is pregnant. And the brothers are saying that vile creature who did this to our sister, he's going to have a child that's going to grow up in our house? No way! The second the baby's born, we're killing it. And Dina runs to her father and says, I'm going to lose this baby. And Yaakov says, no, you won't. But Yaakov realizes that his sons cannot be trusted. They went and killed the whole city behind his back. They didn't talk to him. Yaakov says, I could say no. But what's going to happen when I'm not home? One day there'll be this accident. I'll come home and find a, oh, we're so sorry. The baby rolled off the bed. You wouldn't believe what happened. A fire broke out in the tent, Dad. You wouldn't believe it. Yaakov Avinu realizes that he cannot secure the baby. So when the baby is born, Yaakov takes the baby and travels south to Egypt. And he looks for a family that can adopt the baby. And when he travels south to Egypt, he meets a family where the woman is a very, very pious woman, almost ready for prophecy. And the man is a eunuch. He can't have kids. So even though it's Egypt, where anything goes, people sleep with their daughters, people sleep with their sisters, people exchange wives, but this couple is different. The woman can be trusted to raise her up the way she should because the woman is a pious woman. The man can be trusted because he just can't do anything. His name is Potiphar. Potiphar, who is the chief executioner for Pharaoh, happens to be married to a pious woman. A woman who's a good, kind person. And so Yaakov Avinu prepares a locket, a jewel, that he gives this granddaughter of his, the daughter of Shechem from Dinah, and he writes down to her, you're a Jew, and you come from Israel. and you are a part of the Jewish people. And he writes down her story in Hebrew. And he entrusts her down in Egypt by this couple to raise her. And the couple do a phenomenal job. The girl grows up to be a pious, extraordinary lady. And when Yosef will be down in Egypt, he will be serving in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar's wife has this vision where she sees that she and Yosef have to bring the Mashiach to the world. And when she keeps chasing after Yosef, she keeps saying, you know, I see, it's in the stars. We're supposed to bring Mashiach to the world. Only she didn't see it right. It was supposed to happen through her daughter, through her adopted daughter. But when a person raises someone else's child, that child is considered theirs. So much so that a person can write in their ksuba, I am the son of Jack, because Jack brought him up. If Jack adopted him, then you could write, I am the son of Jack. So, that's what it says in the response of the Chassam Sofer. It's a good question.
So then wait, does that mean someone, if someone's like biological parents and
pause,
grandparents...
let's finish the story, and then we'll take other questions. So, this girl grows up there, and then when Yosef is taken around Egypt, and all the girls are dancing on the walls trying to get him to look at them, this girl sees Yosef. They grew up together. Yosef was in Potiphar's house with her. But Yosef was always modest, and she was modest. But now Yosef is being taken around town, and everyone knows that Yosef must be married, that Pharaoh's going to want him married. So what does she do? She takes the locket she has from Yaakov Avinu and throws it, and it lands on Yosef's pocket. It lands on his lap. And he looks down and he sees Hebrew writing. He says, what's that? And he tells the driver, stop. And he looks at the writing and he opens the locket and he sees the letter from his father. He sees his father's handwriting. He says to the driver, find out which girl threw that. Ah, it's the girl he grew up with in Potiphar's house. He summons the girl. Pharaoh says, I like the match. Because this is proof that you did nothing wrong in Potiphar's house. If Potiphar lets you marry his daughter, that's proof that you're exonerated. Great idea, Yosef, marry her. And from then on, Yosef builds a family with her. She proves to be an exceptional Eshes Chayil. She will bring up those children in the most defiled place on the planet, where they grow up seeing people all around them doing the most decrepit things. Women sleeping with women. All types of paganism and sorcery. Every vile act you can imagine was happening all around them. And they end up being like the tribes who grew up under Yaakov Avinu. She ends up being the most extraordinary mother. And we bless our children. God should make you like those two children who were able to stand up to all forms of spiritual adversity and thrive. That's exceptional. Every other tribe had their brothers other than Yosef. So we bless our children with that. Now let's go back to the beginning of the story. Dina was violated by a cruel man. A man who is disinterested in honesty, in fairness, in anything that's basic and moral. And so you would say, what type of daughter will Dina have from this man? Maybe the brothers are in the right. Of course she should have an abortion. Of course the baby shouldn't be allowed to live. And yet Chazal show us it didn't work out that way. Every person has their free will. People from the worst background can become the best people. And look at this beautiful example of how Osnas, this girl, Osnat, the daughter of Dina from Shechem, ends up being this most beautiful human being. So that's the medrash about what happened with Dina until she finally came home, until she gave birth, and the heart-wrenching story of how her daughter had to be brought up down in Egypt, not by her, but rather by strangers. Did Dina ever marry or not is two opinions in the medrash. Chazal say Shimon took her into his home, and ultimately when Shimon passed away, he ordered that her body be taken with his, and she is buried right next to Shimon here in Israel, in the land of Israel.
Was she dead yet?
No, she lived. She lived. She lived for a long time.
Wait, so they killed her, like, to be buried with Shimon?
No, no, when she passed away. And then when the Jews left Egypt, they took the bones of the tribes. Each tribe took their progenitor with them. Well, Shimon ordered that Dinah's body be taken with his to be buried in Israel. So his tribe not only took the body, his body, they also took the bones of Dinah, and they were buried together in Israel.
They took Ephraim, all the tribes?
Yes. Each tribe took their...
Only yours.
They did. If they took them, then I guess they knew where.
No, now, today.
Ah, some of them, yes. I think it's in the city of Arbel. Shimon's grave, I think it says, is in the city of Arbel.
All the way to Tveria?
I think that's what it says.
Arbel.
I think that's what it says. If you look at my notes online, I have it written somewhere in the name of someone. I don't remember.
Other tribes also known? Judah,
some of them, yeah. The Re Ibn Shuib says that it's in the city of Arbel, next to the grave of Nitai HaArbeli. That's at the Re Ibn Shuib, the disciple of the Rashba, wrote 600 years ago, 650 years ago. Okay.
And obviously, Dina was opposed to having her child sent away, right?
I don't know about that. I have no source that it was done against her will. I don't know. Yes, sir.
We see this concept of the women wondering if they would be married, that after an event like that happened, about like the general like piety of the time that like a woman who had like a traumatic incident like that, like simply that she'd lost her virginity, it's really like there was a concern about who would be willing to marry her. That's such a
alors dit que le début de la destruction du Beth Amikdash va être le soir du 10.
I guess you could do it that way. I don't know. I don't understand it, so I don't know. So what was their right to kill all the people of Shechem? Rambam says the people of Shechem had a responsibility to keep the Noahide laws. One of them is to have a legal system. There was no legal system that would, that the sons of Yaakov could access. They're living in a city. The head of the city just stole and violated their daughter, and they don't have any legal track to take her back. So they said, then this city is not fulfilling the Noahide laws. If we have no way of defending our most basic right, then the city is in they're in violation of the Noahide laws of establishing a court. We have no court to go to. So then they said, okay. So then they deserve the death penalty. That's Rambam's interpretation.
Seems pretty extreme, like an entire city. Like, why not just the king and his family?
Right, so that's what Yaakov thought they were going to do. Yaakov thought they would ask everyone to circumcise, and then they would easily be able to overpower them and take Dina from their house. And if they have to kill someone, they'd only kill the perpetrator, but not the whole city. So that was Yaakov's approach. So Hashem tells Yaakov, go bring your sacrifice. Chazal tell us there are three things that cause a person to be re-examined in heaven. If a person travels in a dangerous place alone, so then in heaven they say, let's check it out. Does he deserve to make it out alive? If a person sits in a house that's unsafe to sit in, he's sitting in a rickety house that could collapse on him any minute, in heaven may say, does he deserve to make it out alive? And if a person takes on a vow and doesn't pay his vow, so in Shemaim they say, wait a second, does he deserve to make it out alive? So that's what happens to Yaakov. Because he didn't keep his vow, he said, I'll pay a tithe, and he didn't. So then he ends up suffering the story of Dinah and Shechem, and his wife is going to die on him, until finally Hashem says, go pay your vow! And very often we walk around with this claim hovering on top of us, and we don't even realize we have a debt we have to pay, and that's what's holding us back from attaining an easier life. So Yaakov is going to go pay his vow. So Hashem tells Yaakov, go bring your sacrifice you promised. Yaakov tells his family, purify yourself. We're going to go dedicate the altar in honor of Hashem the way I promised over 20 years ago. Hashem brought me to here and everything took care of me. So they start looking through their loot to make sure they're going to get rid of any idols and stuff that they captured. So it means very often we want to charge forward and we don't pay attention that we're dragging along with us all kinds of schmutz, all kinds of filth that we have from our history. Sometimes in life you want to grow, you should clean out your history. A person's going to get married, he should clean out his Facebook page. You don't need every filth and every picture and every girl who you knew and whatever on your Facebook page. Clean out some of your past when you try to move forward. You want to grow? Great, grow. But part of growth is also to clean out some of the past. To clean out, Yaakov tells them, let's be pure as we go to build this altar, this temple. And this is a recurring theme in Torah. That Torah says, don't bring to the temple et nanzana. Don't bring me a gift that was given to a woman of ill repute. Why not? It's money. What difference does it make? Does money have a smell? Does money have a taste? Does money have a flavor? It's money, right? Wrong. Says the Torah, I don't want that money. Don't want that money, right?
Says it here.
That's mine, but I don't think it's more pizza coming here. It's Danny Cooperman. Sorry, guys. So Yaakov goes to Beit El and he brings a sacrifice. He gets word that Devorah, Rebecca's nurse, passed away. Our sages say, what was she doing there? Shabbat Shalom. Rivka had sent her to help him bring up the kids. Rivka says, my son's coming back with all these babies. I got to send him and help the kids. Hashem tells him, your name is no longer going to be Yaakov, it's going to be Yisrael. The name Yaakov connotes Okba, doing things twisted. The name Yisrael connotes straight. You are a victor. You can face your challenges and overcome. And Hashem tells him, Prei Urvei, I want you to be fruitful and multiply. You still have what to produce in this world. You will have kings come out of you. And our sages say from here, it was understood that from the tribe of Binyamin would be two kings, not only one. And Hashem says, nations will come of you. A nation will come of you. From here we learn that every tribe is considered its own nation in certain ways, in certain respects, because there was only one tribe left to be born. So Yaakov establishes the Temple Mount is a place of worship. And he calls it Beit El. And Chazal say that there are different relationships to the Temple Mount. Avraham Avinu called it a mountain. Be'ar Hashem Yirai, on the mountain Hashem is revealed. Yitzchak called it a field. Yitzchak goes out to the field to pray. What's the field? The Temple Mount. Yaakov Avinu calls it home. We have an involvement of a relationship with the Temple Mount. By Yaakov, it's called Beit El, the home of Hashem. They're traveling, and they're not far from Ephrat when Rachel starts to give birth, and her birth goes wrong. Her labor evolves incorrectly, and she's having a very difficult labor, and things aren't going right. And the midwife says, don't worry, Your whole life you were waiting for a boy. This is also a boy. And she dies giving birth. And she names the child Ben Oni. Now the word Oni could mean my sorrow. The word Oni could mean my strength. And so it could come from the word Aninut, weeping, sorrow. It could come from the word On, strength. And so his father calls him Benjamin, the son of my right, the son of my strength.
Why does he change the name?
He didn't want a name that connoted sorrow. Mm-hmm. It's very important. Chazal say, Devora is not such a great name. Bees are things, they give honey, but they also sting. Chazal say, Chulda is not such a great name. Chulda is some kind of rat, weasel, causes harm, causes damage. So yeah, there were prophetesses who had the name Chulda and Vora. Chazal say, it wasn't so great that they had those names. So Yaakov wants Binyamin to have a positive name. So Rachel is buried there. Chazal say, for a woman, the greatest honor is bury her as soon as he can. Especially a woman that dies at childbirth. The female fluids that come out when a woman dies, it's disgraceful for the woman. A woman should be buried right as soon as possible. So Yaakov doesn't schlep her body anywhere. He buries her there, and he erects something over her grave that is connotes this is the grave site of Rachel.
Isn't that interesting?
Where is Kever Rachel? Okay.
Then Benjamin was born there.
You were born there?
So, Chazal say that the next pasuk describes how Reuven went, and the pasuk words it as he lay with Bila, and Chazal say that's not what happened. Our tradition is that Yaakov's bed was always in Rachel's tent. And when he'd go to the other wives' tents, they had a shared bed. But he didn't have his bed there. His bed was in Rachel's tent. And when Rachel passed away, so Yaakov Avinu put his bed by Bilhah. Reuven said, my mother suffered from Rachel her whole life. And now Rachel died. So it's only legitimate that now dad's bed goes to mom. And fighting for his mother's honor, he went and took the bed and moved it to Leah's tent so as to fight for his mother's honor. If we think about it for a minute, we can understand what Reuven did. If you think about it for another minute, you can understand what Yaakov Avinu did. If we move forward to next week's parsha for a minute, Yosef will have a dream. And in the dream, he will see the sun and the moon bowing down to him. And they're going to wonder, who is the moon? Right? His mother's dead. And Chazal say, the moon is Bilhah. Because when Rachel passed away, the one who took over the orphans was Bilhah. So if you think about it for a minute, the message Yaakov Avinu might have wanted to ensure was passed to Yosef and Binyamin is, you're not alone. I know my other kids have a mother. You guys are not alone. Bilhah is taking over for Rachel. So Reuven feels that his mother's being slighted. But in fact, Yaakov might have had a totally different calculation. Now, why is this so important? On our simple level, we have to take away an important message here. Very often as kids, we think we know what our parents are doing. And we think we're entitled to an opinion over what they're doing. And as was the case with Reuven, our opinion is very often critical of our parents. And we're sure that our perspective is important and right. And it might be. But it might be missing the point. Yaakov Avinu perhaps was factoring the needs of the orphans, and Reuven was factoring his mother's honor. So Reuven has a point, but who said his point wins? Was Reuven aware of what Yaakov had to contend with, raising two orphans? Was Reuven aware of what Yaakov had to calculate? Chazal say that the Shekhinah would be present over Yaakov's bed. And in some way, Yaakov realized that that would happen more when his bed was by Bilhah's tent than if it would be by Leah, with all due respect to Leah. So the Pasuk gives it to Reuven. The Pasuk words it in a way that would make Reuven turn in his grave. The Pasuk says Reuven slept with Bilhah. And what the Pasuk is saying is Reuven's interference in something so delicate as to where his father puts his bed is the equivalent of having slept with his father's wife. You don't belong there. There are things that aren't spoken about, and there are things that are certainly not done, such as interfering. What?
He didn't actually.
Our tradition is that he did not. That he did nothing of the sort. Yes? So I said that in the other women's tents, they must have had a double bed. Their bed was big enough that he slept with them in that bed. In this tent, he had his bed. Correct. Now, if we take it a step further, I would guess that if it's one shared bed, then when the woman is menstruating, then he's not in the bed. If it's two beds, then even when they're prohibited, he's there in the tent with her. But that's my guess. I never saw a commentary that explains it that way. I'm saying that's Netanel Frankenthal. I don't know if that's true. I'm saying if we wanted to take it another step further, then all of them were pregnant. When a woman's pregnant and nursing, so you have 9 months that she's not menstruating, and another 2 years that she's not menstruating after giving birth. So having his bed in Rachel's tent was because Rachel was not having kids. So she was finding herself every month, spending half the month permitted to her husband, half the month prohibited. The other women were permitted straight for 9 months, and then again straight for 2 years. So for Rachel, the message was important, at least in the beginning. The idea of having a separate bed, that he's with her even when they can't be in the same bed. Again, this is Netanel Frankenthal speaking. I'm saying I don't have a source for what I'm saying. I'm putting the pieces of the puzzle together. Maybe that's the message here. Chazal tell us that Yaakov's bed is a spiritual thing. Chazal say a bed is like an altar. A bed is a holy thing. We don't look at a bed as just the place you sleep. Chazal say the Shekhinah rests by a person's bed. Chazal say Yaakov was carried with his bed to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Chazal say Yaakov wouldn't have anyone defile touching his bed. So we don't look at a bed as just a place where you go to sleep. The literal wording of the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch is that a person's bed should be placed between north and south. So we interpret that to mean when a person's intimate with his wife, their head should be to the north, their feet should be to the south. But the Gemara didn't say that. Right. The Gemara said the head of the bed should be to the north and the tail of the bed should be to the south. We take that as a euphemism, as a nice way of saying how intimacy should be performed. But the Talmud spoke about the bed. Okay. The Torah is quick to tell us Reuven was Yaakov Avinu's first son. The Sephorno says, when we will learn in next week's parsha, that Yosef is saying not nice things about his siblings. He's saying that they're being intimate with prohibited women. Says the Sephorno, that's this story. Yaakov Avinu didn't know who of his sons was inappropriate. Yosef goes to his father and says, Dad, it was Reuven who did it. The Pasuk says in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles that when Yaakov understood what Reuven had done, he said, Reuven, You were supposed to be the father of kings. You were supposed to be the father of Kohanim, priests. You were supposed to be my firstborn and get a double portion in the land of Israel. Because of what you did, the Kahuna will go to Levi. The Malchus will go to Yehuda. The rights to a double portion will go to Yosef, my first son from Rachel, not from you. So when he intervened, he lost. And now Reuven will have to do tshuva. And in a way, he is the first to pursue the concept of tshuva, as we will discuss, even though Adam HaRishon did tshuva, Kayin did tshuva, Reuven's tshuva is different. But that we'll have to discuss next week. So Yaakov comes back to his father Yitzchak. And he's by Yitzchak until Yitzchak passes away. And the truth is that Yitzchak is actually alive for many years after this, into next week's parsha. Yitzchak will be alive 12 years into next week's parsha. The Torah just wants to conclude the story, to tell us the end of Yaakov with his father Yitzchak. But in fact, in next week's parsha, when Yosef is sold, and Yaakov thinks he's dead, and Yaakov goes into a 20-year mourning period, it says over there, Vayevkoto Aviv, his father wept over him. So we read that as, Yaakov was weeping over Yosef. Chazal say, no, Yitzchak was weeping over Yaakov. Vayevkoto Aviv, when Yaakov entered this state of sorrow to weep over Yosef for 20 years, his father Yitzchak was weeping over Yaakov. And so our tradition is that Yitzchak is going to live for another 12 years into next week's parsha, but the Torah isn't going into that. The Torah is ending the story, not in chronological order. So Yitzchak passes away, and Esav and Yaakov bury him. That shows us that till the end, Esav didn't respect Yaakov. Even though he had sold his rights and everything, it didn't matter. Esav still led the way in burying him. Chazal tell us, when did Rivka die? Doesn't say. Chazal say it was hidden. Because Yitzchak was forgotten to the world. Yitzchak spent decades in a dark house. He had gone blind. He was irrelevant to the world. The world didn't know he existed. He was in a dark house. Rivka was in and out of the house all the time. So when Rivka passed away, the world was talking. What was the world saying? Nothing. Because Hashem made it that when she passed away, she had a quick, quiet burial. Because had people heard that she passed away, people would have started talking. They would have said, what trouble she brought to the world. She's the one that mothered Esav. She brought such disaster and evil to the world. So out of respect for Rivka, Hashem made it that when Rivka died, she died at night. They quickly prepared her body and she was buried. Yaakov wasn't around to take care of her burial. Esav wasn't too pleased with her because he knew that she had taken Yaakov's side. And Yitzchak was incapable of doing a proper burial. So the servants did a quick burial and everything was done. This was to save her that shame. People shouldn't say she mothered Esav.
But why? I mean, she also mothered Yaakov.
Right. But Yaakov wasn't around. The people of Israel had suffered at the hand of Esav. What they knew was that part of it. So that's why it records earlier that the maid, Dvorah, passed away. Our tradition is Yaakov heard his mother passed away and he felt very, very bad because he never got to see his mother again. His mother had told him, come back after you find a wife. And he was on his way back when he gets word that his mother had already passed away. So Yaakov's not a young man. He's almost a century old. But it's still painful. The end of the parasha records Esav's genealogy. If we look closely, it's very interesting, the story of Esav's genealogy. He has a wife named Alivama, he calls her Yehudit. So his father will think that she denies paganism, even though she was an outright pagan. But he gives her a name that will make her look good. I'm not sure that we only see that in the negative sense. It might be positive to make the parents feel good. Sometimes a daughter-in-law will wear pants, but next to her in-laws, she won't. At least she does that. The pasuk describes Alivama as being the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Tzivon. So the question is, you could only be the daughter of one man. What does that mean? She is the daughter of Anna and the daughter of Tzivon. So our sages say that when Anna was out of the house, Anna was Tzivon's son. And when he was out of the house, so Tzivon slipped into the house and slept with his daughter-in-law. And that's why the Pasuk describes Ohalivama as being the daughter of Anna and the daughter of her grandfather, Tzivon. The Pasuk is telling us you should know who Esav married. Mamzerim. The Pasuk says he also married Bosmat, and yet in another place she's called Machalat. So here we have a very important medrash. The medrash says, why is Basmat called Machalat? To tell us that when you get married, you get Mechila. This is the source for the concept that when a person gets married, his sins are atoned for. That's why her name was changed to Machalat. There are three people whose sins are atoned for. One is a person that becomes a leader. Two is a person that gets married. Three is a person that converts. Ger shenit geyer. When a person converts,
point of that event.
Correct. So it's a new beginning. Hashem forgives him for his transgressions. It's just like a person who got married gets forgiveness. Our custom is that when a person gets married, they fast on the day of their wedding because it's like Yom Kippur. Their sins will be forgiven. I do not know why gerim do not have this custom of fasting on the day of their giyur. Never heard of a ger do it. I've never heard of such a custom, but I would think it's the same thing.
It's a custom that most people
chatanim,
do
Ashkenazi chatanim fast on the day of their wedding. Now there's another reason which is important to know. The other reason is so that you don't show up to the wedding intoxicated. You're about to sign a contract, you have to be with it. I know of a Kala that on the day of her wedding had a terrible cold. So her grandmother came and she started making her soup and chili and all kinds of stuff that would clear her up. And she kept giving her cognac. She kept giving her whiskey to drink. She said, it'll help clean you up. It'll help clean you up. And this Kala told me she showed up to her wedding tipsy. And I'm thinking, that's interesting. You know, that's exactly what Chazal did not want you to do on your wedding day. One of the explanations as to why we have this custom of fasting on the wedding day is to ensure you're not intoxicated when you cut the deal. Yes?
Is it really all the sins, or is it like for something that
comes? I don't know.
Like if you murder.
Right, I don't know. I don't know.
And is that to say that a ger, up to the point of his giur, he doesn't need to make tshuva?
I don't think so.
Same thing with the wedding?
I don't think so. People do tshuva on what they did before the wedding, for sure. Still, there's an element where this is an atonement. The Pasuk then describes that Ohalivama gave birth to Yeush and Ya'alam and Korach. The problem is that Korach is the son of Eliphaz, but Korach is described as the son of Eliphaz from Esav's wife, meaning Ohalivama is Esav's wife. So how does Esav's son have a child from Esav's wife? So if you look closely at the Pasuk, what the Pasuk is telling you is that that Eliphaz slept with his father's wife. His father must have been away hunting, and he came back home and slept with her, and from there they had the child named Korach. So Esav thinks it's his kid, but really it's his son who slept with his wife's kid. And again, the Pasuk is revealing to us the bastards that were a part of Esav's genealogy. Right? Esav's wife, he said, was Ohalivama, who came from Tzivon sleeping with his mother, right? Tzivon sleeping with his daughter-in-law, the wife of Anna. And here Eliphaz slept with his father's wife and had Korach. And then Esav takes his family and he moves to the mountain of Seir. And here Rambam says the Torah identifies the genealogy so that we wouldn't kill innocent bystanders. When we have the mitzvah of killing Amalek, we won't kill the other people who are not Amalek. Why does Esav leave? So Chazal say, Esav says to his grandson Amalek, he says, why should we be a part of Avram's heritage? Avram was told his descendants would be enslaved. They're going to suffer. Let's leave. Let them suffer. They'll finish their 400 years in Egypt or wherever it will be, they'll suffer. Then when they leave and they want to come inherit the land of Israel, then you attack them, wipe them out, and then we'll be the sole descendants of Avram, and we will get the land of Israel. Right now, let's let them stay. Because in order to get the land, they have to undergo all the suffering. Let them suffer. And that's why when we leave Mitzrayim, Amalek attacks us right away. Because that was the plan. That was the deal. Esav left this message. Let them have it. When they come out, attack them. At the end of the parasha, we have a pasuk that's quoted numerous times. It says, Timna was a concubine for Eliphaz. Why was Timna a concubine? So Chazal tell us, Timna came from an aristocratic family. It says she was the sister of Lotan. That means she came from the family that leaded, that they were the leaders of the tribe of Seir. She came from the royal family. Why would she, a royal princess, go and become a concubine for Eliphaz? So she said, I want to be a part of Avram's family. And she saw she couldn't get in, so she said, at least let me be a part of Esav's family. She saw she couldn't get in, so she said, let me at least be his concubine. So she was the concubine for Eliphaz, Esav's son, and she gave birth to Amalek. So Chazal tell us that the greatest enemies of the Jewish people came from people who wanted to come close to the Jewish people. Timna went to Avram Avinu and said, I want to be a part of the Jewish people. And Avram pushed her off. And Chazal say Avram made a mistake that he pushed her off. And when she saw she couldn't get in and become a part of the Jewish people, so she at least joined the Eliphaz, and from there came Amalek. Chazal tell us that throughout our history, when we pushed people away too hard, so that developed the greatest enemies of the Jewish people in the story of Timna and in the story of Yeshu. Twice people were pushed off more than they should have been pushed off. Huh? You want to say Gehazi too? Okay, I hear. Yes?
So a couple questions. One, I thought Abraham died way before this.
It happened way before this.
And two,
Achot Lotan Timna is a pasuk way back when. It's not now.
Okay.
Timna is an old lady already.
Okay. And two, so, but so Christians evolved from Esav, right?
So, it seems that Esav's descendants were the pro-inhabitants of the lands which adopted Christianity.
Because like J.C. and the earliest Christians started off as Jews.
Right.
So they were still from Yaakov.
Correct.
Okay.
Not very successfully, though.
What?
It's historical note. It didn't make a lot of inroads among the Jews in a big, big way. It was only until after Paul with the Jew and
well, no, I'm not getting into like the history of it. Who do they descended from?
They didn't really descend from us. That's their point.
From who?
They didn't really descend from the Jews. Like at Pauline Christianity is completely different from pre-Pauline Christianity. And post-Pauline Christianity is for the Gentiles.
I mean, if you look at JC though, he was a Jew.
If he ever existed. Which is absolutely
not. I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't get into it.
Yeah, and that's the Gemara. It's meant to be if he's 200 years before anything that Decker existed. First record we have with that, through that, he was coming back.